Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Peter Stone, who heads the money and politics team at the Centre for Public Integrity, and examine a previously unreported secret meeting between Mitt Romney and Newt Gingrich, revealed in the Washington Times, to determine whether Gingrich, who has helped Romney throughout the Republican primary by splitting the anti-Romney vote, has made a deal with Romney to drop out. Gingrich denies that he made such a deal, and he also denies he made a deal with Romney to help with campaign debts or to get a position in a Romney administration. Then we will examine the possibility that Israel has found a way to make an attack on Iran feasible by using air bases in Azerbaijan. An historian and author specializing in foreign affairs and intelligence analysis, Mark Perry, joins us. He has an article at Foreign Policy, Israel's Secret Staging Ground, and we will discuss whether, after striking targets in Iran, the Israeli Air Force could land and refuel at nearby Azeri airfields. Then finally, we will speak with Van Jones, the founding president of Rebuild the Dream and author of a new book, Rebuild the Dream. We will discuss the forthcoming 99% spring in which 100,000 Americans will mobilize to advance economic fairness and social justice at a time when billionaires are buying our elections and conservative activist judges are threatening to undo access to affordable health care. Joining us now is Peter Stone, who heads the money and politics team at the Center for Public Integrity. As a journalist, he's covered a wide array of lobbying and campaign finance issues in Washington for the Legal Times and the National Journal. He began his career at the California-based muckraking magazine Ramparts, and his latest book is Casino Jack and the United States of Money, Super Lobbyist Jack Abramoff and the Buying of Washington. He has an article at McClatchyDC.com. Gingrich backer Adelson hosts dinner featuring Romney supporters. Welcome to Background Briefing, Peter Stone.
Thanks very much, Ian.
And we're getting reports now of a secret meeting that took place between the candidates on the Republican presidential side, Romney and Gingrich, in Louisiana, and speculation that maybe it's about him getting out, Gingrich getting out. But isn't it pretty logical, Peter, that as long as Gingrich has been in this race, it's been helping Romney. And if Adelson wants to help Romney, then the best way to help Romney is to fund Gingrich.
Well, I think up to a certain point that logic may have been operative. And I don't think it is really too much anymore. I mean, I think Gingrich, as Adelson said yesterday to a small publication, I don't know if it's based in Vegas, but they talked to him as he was leaving a meeting in Vegas yesterday, and he said that Gingrich appeared to be, quote, at the end of the line or at the end of his line. And the point being that he has virtually no hope any longer of getting the nomination. And it's my understanding that it's pretty unlikely, not definite, but pretty unlikely, since Adelson is a very independent-minded fellow and is very, very close to Gingrich, historically long funded a PAC of his before the campaign, a political operation of his, and shares a strong agreement about a hard line on Israeli issues and support for Netanyahu. It seems like there's less likelihood that that support will continue. And I think at some point realism kicks in that all the many GOP leaders are coming aboard with Romney. And while he doesn't have the thing sewed up, he seems to have, you know, a definite big edge. So my sources have told me that it's likely that Adelson family members are going to be supportive of the nominee for sure. And if it's Romney, that will be Romney and his super PAC, which will be probably get millions of dollars from Adelson and or his family when Gingrich steps aside, or perhaps even slightly before he steps aside.
Well, Peter Stone, it's just pretty much simple mathematics, isn't it? That Gingrich has been splitting the anti-Romney vote for some time. And it's also, I don't think, unfair to suggest that Gingrich is somebody that would like to be taken care of and have his campaign debts forgiven or paid for by somebody else and get some good lobbying contracts. And I mean, he's made himself available to anybody who wants to pay him. A lot of the people on the road, the journalists covering the Gingrich campaign, find him not to be entirely serious. He seems to spend a lot of time in expensive restaurants and seems to be running this thing out of his back pocket. So forgive me if I'm a little skeptical about him being a stalking horse for Romney.
I'm not sure at this stage again what your, what the logic is. I think, I think his days are numbered in the campaign. As one GOP operative told me today in Washington, it seems unlikely that Gingrich will step aside before Santorum does. And just because the rivalry, as you point out, has been intense there, splitting the anti-Romney vote. Santorum's, I guess, decision point may be the Pennsylvania primary, which he has to win, just like Gingrich had to win the Georgia primary. And that comes the end of April. I think Santorum is in the race for another, month or so, maybe a little longer. He's got more money than Gingrich does at this point in both his campaign and his super PAC. Super PACs, as you know, have been extremely important this election season, sometimes spending more than the campaigns themselves, and funded by multimillionaires and billionaires like Mr. Adelson. So I see Newt going through probably the next month or so. And then, depending on what happens in the Pennsylvania primary, both men could be out after that, or they could soldier on. It's really hard to say. It's been a crazy campaign season.
Again,
political punditry is not worth very much these days.
well, let's avoid it then. I'm speaking with Peter Stone, who heads the Money and Politics team at the Center for Public Integrity. He has an article at McClatchyDC.com, Gingrich backer Adelson hosts dinner featuring Romney supporters. Let's get to this private dinner that you write about that took place on March the 22nd at Adelson's Las Vegas home. With members of the Republican Jewish Coalition, including the RNC chairman, Reince Priebus, Minnesota Senator Norm Coleman, Mel Sembler, a wealthy Florida real estate magnate, St. Louis investor Sam Fox, D.C. lobbyist Wayne Berman, and also Mitch McConnell, the Senate Minority Leader.
Well, they weren't, slow down, they weren't at the dinner. They came to the meeting later over the weekend.
Okay, on the weekend. This was a pre-dinner before.
This was a private kickoff. This was sort of a kickoff dinner for the Republican Jewish Coalition, which is a advocacy group, very strong pro-Israel advocacy group, a little bit like AIPAC, it's certainly all Republican. AIPAC has Democratic members. This is all Republican. Its budget is small. It's heavily funded by Mr. Adelson, who has been the first among equals, so to speak, in the board for some time. They have several dozen board members. You've mentioned a few of them. Mr. Priebus is not with the board of the Republican Jewish Coalition, but is, one of the most prominent party leaders today. And he was at the dinner, as were the other RJC board members and several dozen other people. There were probably, a few other non-RJC members there. But this was a dinner that Adelson gave to friends and donors and fellow GOP colleagues. And I was told by folks who were at the dinner that, it was signals were sent that once Gingrich is out of the race, Mr. Adelson is likely to send, and his family, his wife Miriam has also contributed millions of dollars this year to Gingrich. They'll both probably fund a Romney super PAC, and they're looking at other groups too. He's well known as a GOP donor. There are other groups, including one that Norm Coleman runs, two that Norm Coleman runs actually, which are dedicated to keeping the House in Republican hands. Last election cycle, they received a $4 million donation from the Republican Jewish Coalition. And Mr. Coleman's group is back looking for more support again this time around. That's a good possibility that they will get it. Adelson has also long been close to Karl Rove. I knew him when Rove was the top political advisor to Bush in the White House in the two administrations of George W. Bush. And as we all know, Rove created last in 2010, two very important groups, American Crossroads, a super PAC, one of the first of these super PACs that can accept and spend unlimited amounts of money, Post Citizens United, and post other court rulings. And now Rove has two groups. One is Crossroads and one is Crossroads GPS, which also received some funding last time around from Mr. Adelson. And they're in line, too, to get more support this time. So that's a picture of some of his other giving, which will be significant this cycle beyond the 16.5, that amazing number that he and his family have already given to Mr. Gingrich's super PAC.
And this is out of a fortune of $25 billion. So,
it's barely a pittance for Mr. Adelson. It doesn't quite register, but it is a token of his, you know, strong support and admiration for Gingrich, which he's had for many years, and the fact that Gingrich is, you know, his favorite candidate in this race. But as I said yesterday, he acknowledged that hope is pretty much gone for Mr. Gingrich. So I think this is where reality sets in, and these other groups, he does have friends in these other groups, colleagues he admires, and so I expect there are going to be many millions flowing to a few other outside GOP groups. Some are super PACs, which must disclose their donors and can, advocate directly for candidates now after the Citizens United decision and another court decision called Speech Now, which came in early 2010. And some of the money is likely to go to their arms that are nonprofit arms, which don't disclose their donors publicly, and have also seen a huge increase in donations since those two court rulings in 2010.
What do you think is the agenda, though, apart from raising money of the Republican Jewish Coalition and the Adelsons of the world who, you know, this election so far seems to be being decided by a few billionaires through super PACs and through these 501c4, you know, fronts that they have. Like Crossroads GPS, that allow the donors to have total anonymity. There's no question that it's already an extraordinary phenomenon, but it's surely going to exponentially get more huge, the amounts of money that are coming in as the general gets underway. Because if you look at Obama's vulnerability, most of it's to do with the price of gas. And I'm just wondering if there's any, you know, we had those long meetings in Washington with Netanyahu, who wouldn't give an agreement on whether or not he would attack Iran before the elections. That would drive up the price of gas. Where do you think Obama's vulnerable? And what do you think these hardliners in terms of Israel that are pouring all this money in, what do you think they want, Peter Stone?
Well, I think you're sort of lumping a few different things together here, but the Republican Jewish Coalition is a very strong ally of the Netanyahu government, and no doubt about that, as is Mr. Adelson. And they think that Obama has been too even-handed in his policies toward the Middle East and toward the Palestinians. I think that is one area of potential vulnerability, but I don't think it's a major one. I think the gas issue is perhaps a bigger one, as is the healthcare issue and the jobs issue. I think all three and a couple other economic issues, but I would put those in the area of major vulnerability. I mean, we still have a tepid recovery that is coming along, economic recovery after the recession. It's definitely picking up some steam at last, but I think there's probably going to be discontent out there with the administration by some of the traditional union voters, as well as other voters, independent voters, who don't think he's done enough to really succeed in boosting a recovery. And there are various reasons for that. Obviously, there was a lot of Republican opposition in the Congress to a bigger stimulus bill, where a good bit of the responsibility may lie. And there are other reasons, too. But, you know, he's going to get some disaffection. Some voters are going to stay on the sidelines or maybe go to the GOP for that reason. But on the other hand, I think the Republicans have done a nice job or a interesting job of undermining themselves through the long primary season, where Gingrich ads, paid for by Mr. Adelson, have undercut Romney's credentials with a lot of voters. And the number of negative ads that these super PACs have run, Santorum, Romney, and Gingrich's super PACs, blasting each other, have chipped away at all their voter ratings. And as we've noticed, they've hurt the Republicans with women voters for some of the more outlandish positions, as well as with independent voters. So I think right now it's looking like the Democrats have a better position than they did a few months ago, both in terms of holding the White House and keeping the Senate. And so it's going to be a real horse race. That's what I would say.
Well, Peter Stone, I thank you so much for joining us.
I thank you. Bye-bye.
Again, I've been speaking with Peter Stone, who heads the Money in Politics team at the Center for Public Integrity. As a journalist, he has covered a wide array of lobbying and campaign finance issues in Washington for the Legal Times and National Journal. He began his career at the California-based muckraking magazine Ramparts, and his latest book is Casino Jack and the United States of Money, Super Lobbyist Jack Abramoff and the Buying of Washington. He has an article at McClatchyDC.com, Gingrich Backer Adelson Hosts Dinner, featuring Romney supporters. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back in a moment talking about the possibility of Israel using air bases in Azerbaijan to attack Iran. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Mark Perry, an author and historian specializing in military foreign affairs and intelligence analysis. His books include A Fire in Zion, Conceived in Liberty, and his latest book is Talking to Terrorists, Why America Must Engage with Its Enemies. He's the recipient of the 1995 National Jewish Book Award and the prestigious Project Censored Award. He has an article at Foreign Policy, Israel's Secret Staging Ground. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mark Perry.
Good to be here.
And it's no secret that Israel's secret staging ground is Azerbaijan, right?
Well, it's no longer a secret. It's been known to, obviously, Israel and Azerbaijan, but it's also been known in the U.S. intelligence community, which is what really got me started in writing the article. And it seems pretty clear there's a very close relationship between Israel and Azerbaijan, and it fits into Israel's calculation on a prospective war with Iran.
And as you point out in your article, in a memo released by WikiLeaks, it quotes Azerbaijan's President Aliyev as describing his country's relationship with Israel as an iceberg. 9/10 of it is below the surface.
Yes, and that 9/10 is the security arrangements, presumably, and I think I show in my article, the security arrangements and military arrangements between Israel and Azerbaijan, which are extensive, including arms sales, which are public, but also security arrangements involving intelligence exchanges and potential monitoring of Iranian actions along Azerbaijan's border with Iran.
Well, the Israelis have already been practicing for an airstrike on Iran. 100 Israeli fighters overflew Greece as a part of a simulated attack on Iran. And the whole point of Azerbaijan is its geography. You couldn't basically get much closer to Tehran than Azerbaijan.
That's right. And I make clear in the article, I don't think that Israeli Air Force fighters are going to attack Iran from Azerbaijan. This remains unknown. But I think there's every prospect that Israeli fighters and bombers could use Azerbaijan as a landing point, especially if they start to run out of fuel over the target in Iran. And I think that they would be welcome there. Now, Azerbaijan today said that no foreign power and Azerbaijan itself would engage in an attack on Iran. But that, again, dodges the question. Would they be served? Would Azerbaijani airfields be used to serve Israeli fighters who could land there after an attack on Iran? And that remains an open question.
But that in itself, Mark Perry, makes an Israeli strike on Iran feasible.
Yes.
Prior to, most analysts say that they couldn't do it without having in-flight refuelers somewhere over Iraq. It's unlikely that Iraq would ever grant the Israelis use of their airspace, given that they're pretty much a country that George W. Bush and his incredible stupidity handed over to Iran. So that's off the table. But if they were able to attack Iran from Israel and then land and refuel on the way out to return to Israel via Azerbaijan, which is not very far from Tehran, the bases are on the Azerbaijani border, are they not?
That's right. And your summary that you just gave is exactly correct. This makes it a lot easier for Israel to attack Iran. They don't have to refuel in the air. They can refuel on the ground for a return trip. It makes search and rescue operations for downed Israeli pilots from Azerbaijan even more probable. And finally, Azerbaijan and Israel have signed an arms agreement where drones, Israeli-designed drones, are being manufactured now in Azerbaijan, and they can be used for reconnaissance over Iran. So this is a very, very close relationship. And I think your summary is quite accurate and well said, that this now makes an attack much more feasible. I don't want to say likely, but it's certainly feasible because they don't have to do the refueling.
Again, I'm speaking with Mark Perry, author, historian who specializes in military foreign affairs and intelligence analysis. He has an article at Foreign Policy, Israel's Secret Staging Ground. And I had previously looked into the possibility of Israel using Georgian air bases. They had a very close relationship, they still have, with the government of Georgia. The defense minister is an Israeli citizen, as is the minister of ethnic affairs. But my understanding is that the neocons, in particular Randy Scheuneman, who was John McCain's national security advisor, when they encouraged Saakashvili, the Russian leader, to flex his muscles, and of course he fell right into Putin's trap, and Putin was able to use that as a pretext to invade and annex quite a bit of the territory. And I believe that since that happened, the use of the Georgian air bases have not been particularly practical or viable, because obviously the Russians would immediately inform the Iranians if aircraft either took off or landed.
I think your understanding of this is exactly my understanding of this. I think that landing or using Georgian air bases is now out of the question. We've seen a shift away from Georgia on the part of Israel with more emphasis on Azerbaijan. And really, it's on the public record. These two countries are very close. Azerbaijan's very attractive for Israel because there is a Jewish population there that is treated very well. There's a lot of confidence in the Israeli leadership about Azerbaijan, and there have been, since 2007, visit after visit from Israeli official to Azerbaijan. They've even, one of Israeli officials who visited Azerbaijan called it a emerging democracy in a very progressive country. Of course, if you read my article in Foreign Policy, you'll see that that's not exactly true.
That's putting it mildly, Mark Perry. I mean, it was always a joke during the Soviet Union that the KGB general, Aliyev, was one of the biggest crooks in a lexicon of extraordinary crooks. And, you know, he gave Brezhnev a diamond brooch and all kinds of trinkets. But he basically ran a kind of mafia-like operation, which has continued under his son, who is now the godfather, if you will, of Azerbaijan. And you know, it's basically, as you describe in your article, Azerbaijan is a thuggish, family-run kleptocracy.
Well, that's right, and the State Department here has come to the same conclusion. Of course, we have a very realistic foreign policy here in the United States. It's not as if we ourselves shun Azerbaijan, but we don't have the kind of deeply rooted relationship, business relationship, and military relationship with a country that Israel has. And in frank, you know, to be honest, in the 3 months that I spent researching this and talking to people about Azerbaijan, the extent of the kleptocracy And the extent of the ties between Israel and Azerbaijan are, frankly, astonishing. I was really taken aback by how deep these ties are and how much we don't know.
Well, we do know, at least there have been reports of activities of Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps inside of Azerbaijan, and I think 22 people have been arrested for spying on behalf of Iran. So clearly the Iranians have been watching this for some time and presumably with some alarm.
I think they're very alarmed. They have had, I don't think there's any denying Iran has taken action. Anytime Israel signs a military agreement with someone, with some country close to Iran, the Iranians respond. So I suppose in one sense, we could say, and I think accurately, that the conflict that we hope doesn't come, at least most of us hope doesn't come, between Israel and Iran, is already in some respects going on. It's surreptitious, it's intelligence-driven, there are assassinations, arrests, a lot of...
Cyber sabotage.
Cyber sabotage, a lot of tough words. This is already happening, and some of it, a great deal of it, is happening in Azerbaijan.
So what about, though, Mark Perry, again, author and historian specializing in military foreign affairs and intelligence analysis, he has an article at Foreign Policy, Israel's Secret Staging Ground. What about the 16 million Azeris living in Iran itself? Are they both, I imagine they're both agents for the Iranian government in influencing Azerbaijan, and conversely, for those Azeris working with the Israelis, they'd also be a fertile ground for recruiting infiltrators or whatever you want to call them.
I think that's right. I will say at the outset, there's no reason to believe that the Azeris in Iran are anything but good Iranian citizens. The Azeris have had difficulty penetrating the Azeri community in Iran. Despite the rhetoric about northern Iran being South Azerbaijan, there's been no separatist movement of any considerable extent. But also, this is worrying for Iran. And it's especially worrying when you have in the Azerbaijan parliament, it's a parliament in name only, people standing up and talking about this revanchist South Azerbaijan, which is really northern Iran. That is worrying. That it's not a headache that the Iranians need. I dare say it's probably not one that Azerbaijan needs, and yet we hear this rhetoric all the time.
So the Azeris are talking about retaking part of their land that's northern Iran in the way that they talk about Nagorno-Karabakh and their conflict with neighboring Armenia?
Frankly, Azerbaijan and Azerbaijan leadership have been very intent to reassure Iran on this specific point, that they do not want a conflict with Iran, that they view them as brothers, that's the word that they use. That they don't want to stage attacks outside of Azerbaijan aimed at Iran. The Nagorno-Karabakh conflict, on the other hand, is almost mother's milk to people in Azerbaijan. They're very angry about it. They view their enemies in the Caucasus as people who need to be taught a lesson. They had a very difficult time in the 80s and 90s on Nagorno-Karabakh, and they want it back. So this takes prominence for them. And yet we do hear this talk in Azerbaijan of the Azeris, 16 million Azeris, as you mentioned, in Iran.
So what is then going on with the other big neighbor in the neighborhood there, Turkey? Turkey apparently is watching Israel's alliance with Azerbaijan very warily, aren't they?
It's very worrisome. As we know from May 2010, when Israel attacked the Gaza flotilla and killed 8 Turks and 1 Turkish American, Turkish-Israeli relationship, which used to be very strong, has deteriorated. And the Turkish government has been angry with Israel ever since, and that relationship has gotten much worse. They're angrier now than ever, and they're very worried about Israel's penetration of Azerbaijan, which has come at some cost to Turkey. They continue to meet with the Azeri leadership to try to iron out the differences. President Erdogan and the Turkish leadership was recently, that is to say yesterday, in Iran. This came up. And I think that Turkey has actually played an adult role here. They're trying to dampen the possibility of conflict. They're trying to mediate the dispute over nuclear weapons in Iran and the nuclear program in Iran. They certainly don't also want Israel playing around on their borders or, if I could add, in Kurdistan, which Israel is doing also.
Well, but surely a big item on the agenda with the Turkish leadership meeting in Tehran with the Iranian leadership would be Syria, because they're on opposite sides in what's becoming more and more of a proxy war.
That's true, and there's no love lost between the Turkish leadership and
Assad.
Right. So, you know, they're trying to dampen that conflict. It's going to be very hard to do. The Iranians are very hardcore on this. They support Assad. I don't think that's going to change. So here we are. It's yet another flashpoint in this great arc from everything that includes the Arab Spring, from Egypt up through Lebanon and Syria and then extending across to Iran, a very dangerous neighborhood.
Well, we know from the emails of the Assad family emails that CNN got hold of that basically the Assad family regime there checks in with the Iranians on almost everything. I mean, it's almost as if Iran is running the place.
Well, it's true. Those were amazing emails, frankly. And Iran feels surrounded, and they are. While Iraq has been pro-Iranian, the Americans still have their hand in, and they have their hand in the Persian Gulf. Israel is now in Azerbaijan. Turkey is having problems with Kurdistan. As I say, it's a dangerous neighborhood, and I think from the Iranian point of view, they really need to hang on to Syria to kind of break through that isolation that they have, and they're very intent to save Assad if they can.
Well, ironically, Mark Perry, the thing that would save Assad and his criminal, brutal regime is an Israeli attack on Iran. I mean, wouldn't that take the entire focus off Assad, and the entire Arab world would be, even though they're not too happy with the Iranians, would, you know, be forced to support Tehran?
I think if there's an attack on Iran, the entire calculation of our conversation here shifts. All the pieces are swept off the board. You would see throughout the Middle East, and particularly the Arab world, real instability and real anger towards Israel. And if you're sitting in Israel, I hope that they see this very clearly, that this would be very counterproductive for them. It would turn potential friends into certain enemies, which is what they've done with Turkey and their bad relations with Turkey. Right now, what Israel needs is a foreign policy which cultivates friendships in the Arab world and not a foreign policy that makes things worse.
Well, it's pretty clear that Netanyahu and Barak are pretty bent on doing something. Whether it's rhetorical or not, I don't know. I mean, obviously, Netanyahu would rather talk about what a terrible country Iran is than deal with the Palestinian issue, which he simply doesn't seem to want to talk about. So it sort of works as a distraction for the Israelis. Just in closing, your article in Foreign Policy, Mark Perry, Israel's Secret Staging Ground, mentions that the defense minister of Azerbaijan recently visited Tehran, where he ruled out the use of Azerbaijan for a strike on Iran by Israel, but he didn't rule out the possibility of Israeli bombers and fighters on their way back from bombing and attacking Iran refueling in Azerbaijan.
That's right. And I think, you know, I keep returning to General Martin Dempsey, the chairman of our Joint Chiefs of Staff, and his words about Iran. He said that the United States believes that the Iranian leadership is rational. My question is, that may be, but can we guarantee the same thing about the Israeli leadership? And that, it seemed to me, was the point of his comment. And I think it's very much in doubt. I would like the Israeli leadership to come out and say, we are going to do our best to try to resolve this diplomatically. We trust the United States to do that. So far, they haven't done it. So I think that an attack on Iran is still it's still a possibility and a strong possibility.
Well, there was a sense that the recent meetings in the White House between Netanyahu and Obama were entirely about whether or not the Americans could get the Israeli leader to say that he wouldn't do it without their permission or without consulting the U.S. And apparently that agreement wasn't forthcoming. There is speculation that the U.S. said, let's just postpone what you're going to do until after the elections, and there may even be some, agreement on the part of the U.S. to help out. All the analysts say that Israel can't do much on their own. Not that anything militarily can really be done, probably, at the end of the day. Recently, just in the Knesset last week, Prime Minister Netanyahu said that there are no such guarantees given to the Americans that the U.S. will not, that the Israel won't strike Iran when they feel it's necessary, and that could be any time.
Yes, that's right, and I can only reiterate that it remains a dangerous situation. I think part of Mr. Netanyahu's calculation must now be that whether and despite the strong strategic relationship he has with the United States, whether this can survive a war in which not a few Americans could die. And if he wants to stay on good terms with the United States, I think he should reset the relationship as much as he can and let diplomacy do the job. But we'll have to wait and see whether he's going to do that.
And I guess what you're referring to, Mark Perry, is that if there were an attack on Iran, Iran would retaliate against Israel via Hezbollah, and they'd rain down rockets on Israel. But they also and they've said that they would do this. I think this closing the Straits of Hormuz is probably a bluff, because that won't help them.
Right.
But they have said that they would retaliate against the U.S. and consider an Israeli attack the same as an American attack. And the U.S. is quite vulnerable in Iran, Afghanistan. And I've been told by officers in the U.S. military in Afghanistan that when they have big firefights, the weapons they pick up on the field are brand new Iranian-made weapons. So Iran's already making life difficult for us, and boy, they could make life much, much more difficult.
I think we have to assume that if Iran is attacked, the Iranian leadership would consider every variable and factor and every option in a response. And sadly, one of those options is an attack on Americans in Afghanistan and our naval units in the Persian Gulf. And once a war starts, it's impossible to predict what its cost will be or where it will end. And as we've seen in Iraq and Afghanistan, the calculations we've heard at the beginnings of the war are often thrown out the window as soon as the first shot is fired. And I think that's what would happen in an attack on Iran.
But thank you very much for joining us here today, Mark Perry.
Been my pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Mark Perry, an author, historian who specializes in military, foreign affairs, and intelligence analysis. His books include A Fire in Zion, Conceived in Liberty. His latest book is Talking to Terrorists, Why America Must Engage with Its Enemies. He is the recipient of the 1995 National Jewish Book Award and the prestigious Project Censored Award. He has an article at Foreign Policy, Israel's Secret Staging Ground. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with Van Jones. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Van Jones, the founding president of the Rebuild the Dream, a pioneering initiative to restore good jobs and economic opportunity, and co-founder of the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights, Color of Change, and Green for All. In 2009, he worked as the Green Jobs Advisor to the Obama White House. Time magazine has named him as one of the 100 most influential people in the world, and he's the author of the New York Times bestseller, The Green Collar Economy. His latest book, just out, is Rebuild the Dream. Welcome to Background Briefing, Van Jones.
Glad to be here.
And you'll be on this Saturday. You'll be speaking at 4:30 p.m. here in Los Angeles at a gathering called All In for the 99%. It's an event for artists and grassroots activists 1 week before the start of the 99% spring. We are certainly seeing examples more and more. Even today, the president tried to take away the oil companies' tax breaks and, in fact, subsidies from the government. That failed. The Supreme Court appears to be possibly going to overturn his signature health care reform bill. So it seems that more than ever, the 1% is flexing its muscles.
Well, that seems to be the case, and I think that that's one of the reasons I think we're going to have a very large fight back on our hands this spring and this summer and into the fall. And you know, this a gathering we're doing on Saturday, it's going to be most of the day. We're going to have a lot of, Russell Simmons is going to be there. He's been supportive of the 99% movement. The idea is that we want to stand up for working middle class folks. It used to be that the pathway out of poverty and into the middle class was get an education and get a house, get a home. Well, it turns out now student debt and underwater mortgages are dragging people out of middle class into poverty. It's the exact opposite of what the so-called American dream was supposed to be all about. People going to college, these kids are graduating off a cliff with tremendous debt and no jobs. And, their parents, 25% of all the homes in America are underwater. And the banks and Fannie and Freddie won't reappraise those houses and say, listen, let's reduce the principal and make these things affordable again. And so we got a big fight on our hands. And it rebuilds the dream, the organization I'm a part of, we're taking on the White House. We're saying you got to fire Ed DeMarco, who's the guy who's keeping Fannie and Freddie from doing the right thing. And we've got to stand up for these students. And so in my book, Rebuild the Dream, comes out Tuesday. And we've got a whole battle plan for how it is we're going to take this country in a different direction. So we have an economy that works for the 100%, not just the top 1%.
Well, it seems, Van Jones, that the 1% is able to mobilize lobbyists and capture the legislative agenda and thwart so much, even the president's signature health care reform. And of course, you were in the White House, and I'm pretty sure you saw up close and personal the power of special interests. In many ways, the president wanted to go with this, what was called the public option, but it looks like the realities of Washington and the power of the lobbies were such that he had to go with the individual mandate, which the insurance companies wanted. It just seems such an extreme irony now that that itself should be in jeopardy after they were given what they wanted, the insurance companies.
Well, the reality is that many of us on the left had been interested in discussing Medicare for all and a single payer option. The public option was never the far left wing option that was being made out to be in the press. That was a compromise in itself from single payer. And so perhaps if we had a single payer solution, again, the politics might not have allowed that, but at least to have a discussion, then you would be in a situation where somebody says, well, I don't want to pay for a public health care system. We say, well, guess what? You may not want to pay for public roads, but you gotta. You may not want to pay for public schools, but you gotta. And you may not want to have an individual mandate for public health care, but you gotta. The problem is that we wound up with a situation where we're trying to make ordinary citizens give their money to a private corporation, and it does create this question, can the government do that? And this is the fault of, on the one hand, obviously the D.C. inside crowd, but we did not put up in the first 2 years of this administration the kind of street level fight that you saw from Occupy Wall Street last year. The only people who were marching were the Tea Party. The only people who were passionate was the Tea Party. So you have the right wing for the first time in American history really monopolizing protest, monopolizing that street heat, and it had a terrible impact. And I think that what the reason we're doing this 99% spring, the reason that Rebuild the Dream and so many organizations, SEIU, MoveOn.org, I mean, so many organizations are joining forces with this 99% spring is that we got to get back on the streets. We have learned now, there's no question about it, that, you know, the street heat works. The Keystone Pipeline fight approved that street heat works, and so did Occupy and changing the conversation. You know, in my book, Rebuild the Dream, you know, we lay out a whole game plan, but I also do a hard analysis of what we did right and what we did wrong. I'm the only person who was a grassroots outsider who was also a White House insider who then became a grassroots outsider again. I have a 360-degree view, and I spare no punches in my book, Rebuild the Dream, explaining what the insiders got wrong, what the outsiders got wrong, and what we need to do going forward so we don't continue to be hammered by the 1%.
And this 99% spring takes place on Saturday here in Los Angeles, where you'll be speaking at 4:30 p.m. at 400 South La Brea. The point being that a week later, the 99% spring begins, in which 100,000 Americans will be trained in nonviolent direct action in order to advance the fairness for the 99%. So this is mobilizing for a belated but much needed movement to take back the country.
That's right, and not only to take it back, but to take it forward. And one of the things that we are trying to break out of now is that we used to, you know, each little organization would have its own training, have its own little conference, its own everything, and we would go up against these massive forces by ourselves. And what the reason to say, you know, the 99%, that implies an awful lot of people. And so the civil rights movement, you know, the freedom schools and trainings were such a big, important part of getting people organized. And so we're casting a very wide net. 100,000 people are going to be trained. We have gone through a very rigorous process of coming up with a curriculum that many, many organizations have now signed on to. I was just on a conference call earlier today with some of the top progressive leaders in the country. And, you know, I think this Trayvon Williams murder and the police embrace of his killer and abandonment of the family has also lit a spark for racial justice as well as economic justice. And so this is going to be a spring where we need to stand up for middle working class people and take back the idea that this is a country where you should be able to work hard and get somewhere. Why are the only people who are able to make it now the ones who have their feet up on a desk somewhere with their computer sitting there doing lightning trades for them? They're not even doing any work. And they're the ones making all the money. And then those of us who work for a living are falling further and further behind.
Well, Van Jones, what is protecting the killer of Trayvon Martin is the Florida Stand Your Ground law, and that's a product of ALEC, who have pushed through all kinds of regressive legislation throughout the states. 32 states have Stand Your Ground laws. They've also pushed forward the voter suppression that's also disenfranchising 5 million Americans, largely African Americans. So in a way, it sounds like what you're trying to do here and others is create a kind of grassroots alternative to the malignant power and influence of the Koch brothers funded ALEC. And it's, by the way, big corporations fund it too, you know, UPS, Walmart. I mean, maybe it's time for some kind of consumer boycott if they're going to take away your vote, take away your kids, have them killed in cold blood.
Well, absolutely. I think we need to go after ALEC. You know, there have often been these shadowy organizations. You know, it used to be the White Citizens Council. That was a shadowy organization that would engineer negative outcomes for minorities that they hated. And now we have an updated 21st century version of the White Citizens Council. It's called ALEC. And you can look it up, A-L-E-C. ALEC is funded by some of the biggest corporations. And, you know, we need to stop calling these despicable laws what they call them. They call it, say, it's stand your ground. No, it's kill at will. This is a kill at will law that they have promoted hand in hand with NRA, but it only applies to a certain kind of people shooting a certain kind of person. And everybody knows what they're talking about with this so-called stand your ground. It's kill at will. And again, in my book, Rebuild the Dream, I talk about the kind of infrastructure that we need to build. See, we thought that when we got Obama elected and we had Pelosi in the Speaker's chair, and we had 60 votes in the Senate, we had enough to govern. And it turns out we did not. We had one-third of what we needed to govern. The other third, one-third is media, and the last third is movement in the streets, grassroots, nonviolent movement. Fox had all the media, and the Tea Party had all the movement, and it turned out that we were able, they were able to checkmate all three branches of government just with those tactics and tools. Well, guess what? We know how to march. The right wing has no monopoly on the ability to put people in the streets. In fact, we're experts at it, but we have not used that. And we also are experts at expressing, communication, networking. We have not unleashed our own power. And that's why I wrote the book, Rebuild the Dream. That's why I started the organization, RebuildTheDream.com. And I'm very proud and excited to be a part of this reemerging movement, this fight back now. And again, now it's not just economic justice, but racial justice coming together, and gender justice with these. This is war on women coming together. If they want to take on the vast majority of people in this country, is it still a democracy? We can stand up. We can beat them.
Well, Van Jones, do you think, though, that the political configuration, if you will, of the U.S. has really changed, and then perhaps there is a new way to look at things? And it seems to me that the 99% versus the 1% really has reframed our political debate, which is kind of frozen in a left-right dynamic. And it seems to me that in many ways the new alignment, if you will, is the inside versus the outside.
As somebody who was on the inside as a White House insider for 6 months, and somebody who's been on the outside, I can tell you that the insiders continue to underestimate the outsiders. They were blown away when Obama came rolling in from their point of view out of nowhere. Then they were blown away when the Tea Party came rolling in out of nowhere. Then they were blown away when Occupy came rolling in out of nowhere, because they consider most of humanity to be nowhere. They consider most of our communities to be nowhere. And so we always have an advantage, which is the advantage of surprise that comes when your opponents underestimate you out of their own arrogance and ignorance. And so, even just the people who agreed with this wonderful reframing of 99 versus 1, and who supported Occupy in theory, that's about a third of the United States. That's 100 million people. Now, that 100 million people were to stand up, or even a portion of it, that could reframe politics permanently going forward. The problem has been that most of us sit around and we worry, oh, well, what can we put forward that the right wing will like, and how can we appease them, and then we were intimidated by the 1%. But the reality is that a small number of young people with sleeping bags, frankly, and struggling folks without a lot of money, were able to find the right tactics last fall, and they completely derailed the Tea Party agenda of austerity and changed the conversation to economic inequality. And they did it almost overnight. And so, just like this, when the civil rights movement was happening, the young people did the sit-ins in February 1st, 1960. And then it got quiet for a few months, and then they did the Freedom Rides, and then it was quiet for a few more months, and then, you know, there was other engagements in, you know, Albany, and so people keep, well, the Occupy movement, it didn't fix everything. Well, no one tactic will do that. But I think where we are now is, you know, we are on the road to building a movement of the 99%. My only view is, it should be the 99% for the 100%, not just against the 1%. We're for everybody doing well in America. We just don't want the only people doing well to be the people who happen to be, you know, hedge fund managers and the worst of the 1%.
Well, just in closing, Van Jones, the event that you'll be speaking at 4:30 on Saturday here in Los Angeles, the All In for the 99% event for artists and grassroots activists, one of the intentions of the event is to demand an end to the Citizens United Supreme Court decision. And now, of course, you could argue that the political fate of the nation is being decided not by the 1%, but by the 0.00063% of a handful of billionaires through their super PACs who are buying up our 2012 elections. However, if you were to overturn Citizens United, which is by no means an easy thing, we'd still have a rotten system, wouldn't we?
Well, sure. I mean, Citizens United is an example, and there are others. But I would not poo-poo too much the both symbolic and practical advantage of having a lawsuit like that to focus the conversation and to begin to focus people's attention on the fact that, as you said, the corporations are now running our democracy. When you run for president, most of the money goes to a committee run by corporations that you don't even have any control over. So you're just even a presidential candidate to be head of the most powerful country in the history of the world is, even at the time of the election, just a corporate puppet, blatantly just a corporate puppet. This is an offense to the right and the left. This is not a left or right issue. This is just, you know, completely counter to even common sense. Even common sense would tell you that if a man or a woman is running for office, he or she should be able to put forth her own views, make her own ads, and control her own money coming in. And that has now been taken away from the people. Even the top people who have been have their rights usurped by these corporations. And so, I appreciate having this time with you. I encourage people, please come out on Saturday. Also, get my book. I'm the only grassroots outsider who was a White House insider, and I can tell you where the mistakes were made on both sides in the last round. And we have a game plan now going forward. Signed on to by 131,000 people. I didn't write it. So 131,000 people got together online and off to write a battle plan to take us forward, to get jobs again, to get better jobs than we had. The job numbers might be going up, but the jobs themselves are going down in terms of their quality, in terms of how much people are getting paid. And it's time for us to stand together.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today in Los Angeles, Van Jones.
Thank you.
And I was just speaking then with Van Jones, the founding president of Rebuild the Dream, a pioneering initiative to restore good jobs and economic opportunity. He's the co-founder of the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights, Color of Change, and Green for All. In 2009, he worked as the Green Jobs Advisor to the Obama White House. Time magazine has named him as one of the 100 most influential people in the world, and he is the author of the New York Times bestseller, The Green Collar Economy. His latest book, just out, is Rebuild the Dream, and you can get that book at rebuildthedream.com. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Chris Scheid. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.